This conference will now be recorded.
Welcome, everybody, to the Tabernacle of David Study Room and the MessianicMessage.com. I'm going to say a prayer and then we can begin. Father, we thank you for this time to study your word and to come before you. And I pray that this time will be a time of us learning and understanding more than we do at this moment. Pray that you'll be with Rick as he teaches in Yeshua's name. Amen. This week's Torah portion is Exodus 1:1 to chapter 6, verse 1, Isaiah 27, starting at verse 1, all the way through chapter 28, verse 13, and then verses 22 to 24 in chapter 29. The Brit Hadashah is Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12, and Acts 7, 17 to 35. We're going to go around the room and everybody take 5 verses. I'll start and we'll go around the room here, and then we'll go around the room online. Exodus 1:1. Now these are the names of the sons of Israel who came into Egypt, every man and his household came with Jacob: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. All the souls who came out of Jacob's body were 70 souls, and Joseph was in Egypt already. Now it's Michael's turn.
Okay. And Joseph died, all his brothers and all that generation. But the children of Israel were fruitful and increased abundantly, multiplied and grew exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And he said to his people, "Look, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, lest they multiply. And it happened in the event of war that they also join our enemies and fight against us, and so go up out of the land."
Cheryl.
So they appointed taskmakers over them to afflict them with hard labor. And they built for Pharaoh storage cities in Pithom and Ramses. But the more they afflicted them, the more they multiplied, and the more they spread out, so that they were in dread of the sons of Israel. And the Egyptians compelled the sons of Israel to labor rigorously, and they made their lives bitter with hard labor in mortar and bricks, and at all kinds of labor in the field, and all their labors which they rigorously imposed on them. Then this king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shiphrah, and the other was named Puah.
And Rick, would you just finish out this chapter?
He said, "When you help the Hebrew women give birth while they are still on the delivery stool, if you see the baby is a son, you are to kill him. But if you see that it is a daughter, let her live." Midwives, however, feared God, so they did not do what the king of Egypt told them to do, but they let the boys live. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said to them, "Why did you do this and let the boys live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women. They are vigorous, so they give birth before the midwives come to them." So God treated the midwives well. The people also increased in number and became very numerous. Because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Pharaoh, however, commanded all his people, "Every son who is born you shall throw into the Nile, but every daughter you shall let live."
And Susan, chapter 2, verses 1 through 5, please.
Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. And his sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. Then the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile, with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her.
Debbie, verses 6 through 10, please.
When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, her baby was crying. And she took pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrew children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a wet nurse from her? Shall I go and call a wet nurse from the Hebrew woman to nurse the child for you?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take the child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. And the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses and said, "Because I drew him out of the water."
Okay, and Sarah, verses 11 through 15, please.
Now it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out to his brethren and looked at the burdens. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that way, and when he saw no one, he killed the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two Hebrew men were fighting. And he said to one who did the wrong, "Why are you striking your companion?" Then he said, "Who made you a prince and a judge over us? Do you intend to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" So Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." When Pharaoh heard this matter, he sought to kill Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well.
Hilary, verses 16 through 20, please.
Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came and drew water, and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away, but Moshe stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, "How is it that ye are come so soon today?" And they said, "A Mitzri delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds, and also drew water enough for us, and watered the flock." And he said to his daughters, "And where is he? Why is that ye have left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread."
And Jeff, finish the chapter, please. And I see that Andrea is with you. Would you like to read, Andrea, in the next chapter?
No, Andrea won't be reading, but I can read through the end of the chapter.
Okay, thank you.
And Moshe desired to dwell with the man, and he gave his daughter Zipporah to Moshe. She gave birth to a son, and he named him Gershom, for he said, "I have been a stranger in a foreign land." During those days it happened that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned because of the work, and they cried out. Their outcry because of the work went up to Elohim. Elohim heard their moaning, and Elohim remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And Elohim saw the children of Israel, and Elohim knew.
Okay, and Roger, chapter 3, verses 1 through 5, please.
I'll be reading for Roger.
Okay. How are you
now
doing?
Now, Moshe. Good, how are you?
We're good.
Now, Moshe was tending the sheep of Yitro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, leading the flock to the far side of the desert. He came to the mountain of God, to Hebron. The angel of Adonai appeared to him in a fire blazing from the middle of the bush. He looked and saw that although the bush was flaming with fire, yet the bush was not burnt up. Moshe said, I'm going to go over and see. See this amazing sight and find out why the bush isn't being burnt up. When Adonai saw that he had gone over to see, God called to him from the middle of the bush. Moshe, Moshe, he answered, here I am. He said, don't come any closer. Take your sandals off your feet, because the place where you are, where you're standing is holy ground. Continue.
Juliet, verses 6 through 10, please.
Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt, and have heard their cry because of their taskmaster, for I know their sorrows. So I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from the land to a good and large land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites and the Hittites, the Amorites and the Perizzites and the Hivites and the Jebusites. Now, therefore, behold, the cry of the children of Israel has come to me, and I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come now, therefore, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt.
Dawn, verses 11 through 15, please.
But Moses said to Elohim, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve Elohim on this mountain. Then Moses said to Elohim, indeed, when I come to the children of Israel and say to them, Elohim of your fathers has sent me to you, and they say to me, what is his name? What shall I say to them? And Elohim said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Moreover, Elohim said to Moses, thus you shall say to the children of Israel, Yahweh Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, the Elohim of Isaac, and the Elohim of Jacob has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial to all generations.
And Bill, verses 16 through, just finish the chapter, please, 22.
Go gather the leaders of Israel together and say to them, Yahuwah, the Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has appeared to me and said, I have been paying close attention to you, and have seen what is being done to you in Egypt. And I have said that I will lead you up out of the misery of Egypt to the land of the Canaanites, the Hittites, Amorites, the Perizzites, Hivites, and the Jebusites, to a land flowing with milk and honey. They will heed what you say. Then you will come, you and the leaders of Israel, before the king of Egypt, and you will tell him, Yahuwah, the Elohim of the Hebrews, has met with us. Now please let us go 3 days' journey into the desert so that we can sacrifice to Yahuwah our Elohim. I know that the king of Egypt will not let you leave unless he is forced to do so. But I will reach out my hand and strike Egypt with all my wonders, and I will do there After that, he will let you go. Moreover, I will make the Egyptians so well disposed towards this people that when you go, you won't go empty-handed. Rather, all the women will ask their neighbors and house guests for silver and gold jewelry and clothing. with which you will dress your own sons and daughters. In this way, you will plunder the Egyptians.
Okay, and F.S. Lee, chapter 4, verses 1 through 5, please. Okay, Vicki, you have your microphone on. Vicki, 1 through 5, please.
And Moshe answered and said, and if they do not believe me or listen to my voice and say,
okay, Vicki, I'm sorry, you're breaking up really bad. You're breaking up. Vicki? We can't hear you. We can't hear you because you're breaking up real bad. Mary, can you read Exodus 4, 1 through 5, please?
Sure. And Moses answered and said, but look, they will not believe me or heed my voice, for they will say, Yahweh has not appeared to you. And Yahweh said to him, what is in your hand? And he said, a staff. And he said, cast it to the ground. And he cast it to the ground, and it became a snake. And Moses fled from before it. And Yahweh said to Moses, put forth your hand, and take it by the tail. And he put forth his hand, and caught it, and it became a staff in his hand, so that they might may believe that Yahweh, God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and the God of Jacob, has appeared to you.
Yahweh said furthermore to him, now put your hand inside your cloak. He put his hand inside his cloak, and when he took it out, behold, his hand was leprous, as white as snow. And he said, put your hand inside your cloak again. He put his hand inside his cloak again, and when he took it out of his cloak, behold, it was turned again as his other flesh. It will happen, if they will not believe you or listen to the voice of the first sign, that they will believe the voice of the latter sign. It will happen, if they will not believe even these two signs or listen to your voice, that you shall take the water of the river and pour it on the dry land. The water which you take out of the river will become blood on the dry land. Moses said to Yahweh, O Lord, I am not eloquent, neither before now, nor since you have spoken to your servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue. Michael?
So Yahweh said to him, who has made man's mouth, or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Lord? Now, therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say. But he said, O my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send. So the anger of Yahweh was kindled against Moses. And he said, is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And look, he is also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what you shall do.
And Cheryl, verses 16 through 20, please.
Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as Elohim to him. And you shall take in your hand the staff with which you shall perform the signs. Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, please let me go that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive. And Jethro said to Moses, go in peace. Now Yahweh said to Moses and Midian, go back to Egypt, for all of the men who were seeking your life are dead. So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of Elohim in his hand.
And Rick, 21 through 25.
Yahweh said to Moshe, when you go back to Egypt, make sure that you perform in the presence of Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put into your hand. However, I will make his heart hard, and he will not let the people go. You will then say to Pharaoh, Yahweh says, Israel is my son, my firstborn, and I have said to you, let my son go to serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Watch out, I will kill your son, your firstborn. In a lodging place along the way, Yahweh confronted him and sought to kill him. Then Zipporah took a flint blade and cut off her son's foreskin and cast it at his feet. Then she said, surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me.
And Susan, starting at verse 26, read through verse 31, please.
So he let him alone, and at that time she said, you are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision. And now Yahweh said to Aaron, go to meet Moshe in the wilderness. So he went and met him at the mountain of Elohim, and he kissed him. And Moshe told Aaron all the words that Yahweh had, which he had sent him, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moshe and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which Yahweh had spoken to Moshe. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed. And when they heard that Yahweh was concerned about the sons of Israel and that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshipped.
And Debbie, chapter 5, verses 1 through 5, please.
Afterwards, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, this, says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, so that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness. But Pharaoh said, who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, nor will I let Israel go. Then they said, the God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go on a 3-day journey into the wilderness and sacrifice to the Lord our God, so that he does not discipline us with pestilence or with the sword. But the king of Egypt said to Moses and Aaron, why do you take the people away from their work? Get back to your burdens. Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them stop their work.
Okay, and then Sarah, verses 6 through 10, please.
So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters of the people and their officers, saying, you shall no longer give the people straw to make brick as before. Let them go and gather straw for themselves, and you shall lay on them the quota of bricks which they made before. You shall not reduce it, for they are idle. Therefore they cry out, saying, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let us work. Let more work be laid on the men, that they may labor in it, and let them not regard false words. And the taskmaster of the people and the officers went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I will not give you straw. Go get yourselves straw where you can find it, yet none of your work will be reduced.
And Hillary, verses 11 through 15, please.
Go ye, get you straw where you can find it, yet not out of your work shall be diminished. So the people were scattered abroad throughout the land of Mitzrayim to gather stubble instead of straw. And the taskmaster hasted them, saying, fill your works, your daily tasks. And then there was straw, as when there was straw. And the officers of the children of Jasharel, which Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and demanded, wherefore have you not fulfilled your task in the making brick both yesterday and today, as were two-four? Then the officers of the children of Jasharel came and cried to Pharaoh, saying, wherefore deal you thus with your servants?
And Jeff, 16 through 20.
straw is not given to your servants, yet they tell us, make bricks. Behold, your servants are being beaten, and it is a sin for your people. He said, you are lazy, lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and bring offerings to Adonai. Now go to work. Straw will not be given to you, but you must provide the quota of bricks. The foremen of the children of Israel saw them in distress when they said, do not reduce your bricks, the daily matter each day. They encountered Moshe and Aaron standing opposite them as they left Pharaoh's presence.
And why don't you just go ahead and finish 21, 22, and 23 for us?
Okay. They said to them, may Adonai look upon you and judge, for you have made our very scent abhorrent in the eyes of Pharaoh and the eyes of his servants, to place a sword in their hands to murder us. Moshe returned to Adonai and said, my Lord, why have you done evil to this people? Why have you sent me? From the time I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, he did evil to this people, but you did not rescue your people.
Okay, and then the final verse is Exodus 6:1. We're going to come back around to Roger to read in the Haftarah. The final verse is, Yahweh said to Moses, now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for by a strong hand he shall let them go, and by a strong hand he shall drive them out of the land. So that concludes our Torah reading. And so now we're going to have Rick's teaching. And so, Rick, you have the floor.
Okay, let's open with a word of prayer, and then we'll begin. Just so we can get set up here. All right. Father, we just thank you so much for allowing us to hear your word and to read it and to speak about it and to learn of you at your feet as to what you want us to do at this time and it's at hand. We pray that you'll open our ears and our eyes and our hearts, that we would take in what you have for us. Be with my mouth and teach me the things I need to say, and help us to learn of your word in Yeshua's name. Amen. In this Torah portion, we see that we begin here where we left off in Genesis, when Joseph was there in the land, and he was the second in command of all of Egypt. He at this time had died, and so did his brothers. Joseph and all his brothers had all died. The children of Israel are still in Egypt. The fear of them is on all of the Egyptians. They asked Pharaoh, what shall we do? What should they do to ensure that Israel will not become so numerous that they were afraid of them? And yet they did not outnumber the Egyptians, but they were everywhere throughout all the land. They were dispersed throughout, doing various projects for Pharaoh and his people. So they also wanted to make sure that Israel would never leave them and their service would stay with them. At this point, they wanted a cheap labor, and they not only despised them, but they feared them. When I was looking at this part, I was thinking, well, how in the world did they fear them? They far outnumbered Israel, but still, there was something about this that we're not being told here. The fear of Yahweh was in them. They were mighty fighters. There was recorded in Jasher and elsewhere that there was a fight or a war between the children of the East, Esau's people, which were the Edomites, and a lot of other nations around them, going into Egypt after they heard that Joseph was dead. Yet, there were only a small number of fighters at that time, like 125 to 200 people. Egypt had thousands and thousands and thousands of armies, of the army. They had chariots, they had horses, they had war weapons. And they went out against these people, and they were defeated before them. In fact, they were so much afraid of them, they came back and said, you have to fight with us. You have to fight for us against them. And so they went out,
And they fought the children of the east, the Edomites and all the countries around them, and they were victorious over them. Just a handful of Israelites. This stayed with the Egyptians all throughout this whole time, and where they said they were afraid of Israel. So in this, we are reminded that just because there are a few of us does not mean necessarily we're going to lose. It means that we have Yahweh on our side. He will fight for us. It's mentioned many times in the scripture from this point forward that were a few men who were devout to Yahweh. We see it over and over again that they were able to conquer and to win battles that would today's army couldn't happen. We have to have millions of people in our army. They have to have millions of people in their armies. And yet the wars are determined not by how many people, but how much armament, how smart their technology is. It's a war of technology more than it is about people fighting each other. So just because there's a few of them or a few of us, don't be afraid, because Yahweh is greater than those who are in the world. It was not because they were outnumbered, the Egyptians. No, it's because Yahweh's hand was upon them. Even though there were few, Yahweh fought through them and was victorious. So the idea the Egyptians had come up with was to make their work so hard, so laborious, and so hard against them. They had no time to reproduce. And yet, the opposite happened. It produced more. So they said, well, what are we going to do? Well, that's when they went to the midwives. When we come into the story at this point, we see there was a then. Then Pharaoh went to the midwives. And other references I looked at, the then was this council they had before this point, where they were concerned about the number of Israelites, the men of Israel, and how well they fight, and how well Yahweh was on their side. Their God was mightier than their gods. And they were saying, well, if we just let them go, then that'll be fine. They'll go and they'll do what they were supposed to do and go to the land where they came from. Well, Pharaoh didn't like that idea. So he got more counsel. And so this council said, well, if you kill the male children, throw them into the river, that was one idea. The other one was to kill them when they were being born. So then you see that then he went to the midwives. And the midwives, he told them, if it's a male child, kill him. If the daughter, let her live. Well, they feared Yahweh more than they feared the Pharaoh of Egypt. And so they said that, well, they were stronger than the Egyptian women. By the time we got there, it was already over with, and we could determine where the child was. They didn't tell us. They hid him away, and we don't know if it was a male or female. And by that time, it was all done. So there's a time where it seems like that, in our eyes, they lied to Pharaoh. But what they were doing was preserving life. And through this, Yahweh blessed them. And it says they had households of their own. He gave them children. I don't know how old these two women were, but he gave them a house to where they were able to have men and women being born to their families. And just because of this, Yahweh blessed them, because they were faithful to what he said and what. And they were not afraid of Pharaoh. There's going to come a time, and it's often there's a lot of places in our world that we have to stand up against those who say that God is dead or God doesn't exist, or, well, why do we serve a God like that? And we have to have an answer ready for them. We have to be standing on what God has said in his word. We have to be strong in what he has said to us and what to do. So when I looked at this, I said, well, here's two leaders that we're looking at. One was Joseph, and the other one was Moses. Joseph had two dreams, and this was foretelling what would happen in later years of his life, that he would save the house of Israel through what God had called him to do. And at first, it seemed like it was going to be a tragedy. because his brother sold him into slavery into Egypt. Well, it wasn't a tragedy because he was sold into Potiphar's house and became the second in command of his house. It got to the point where Potiphar didn't know anything about what was going on in the house other than he got food going in his stomach, and that's all he cared about. As long as his household was running smoothly, the servants were doing as they were told, he had nothing, everything was in Joseph's hands. And it wasn't until the enemy tried to trip him up and deceive him and have him dishonor Yahweh by his action of adultery. But he didn't comply with what the enemy wanted. He fled before the enemy and left there. And unfortunately, Potiphar thought he was guilty of it, but in fact, he wasn't guilty at all. He was thrown into the prison, but Yahweh was with him in that time also. And every time will be thrown into prison. And how are we going to act? What are we going to do? Are we going to be just to the point where we're so afraid that we're going to give the enemy the things that they want and comply with what their instructions are to us or what God has instructed us to do? Or are we going to be picking Joseph, and he picked up right where he left off with Potiphar, and he started doing excellent work in the jail, and the captain of the jail recognized that in him, and he gave him all the responsibility of the jail. I was a prison guard, and that's a lot of responsibility. He had to know every single person what their needs were. He met them at where they were at. He taught them. He provided for them. And the jailer gave no thought about what was going on in the dungeon. It was all in Joseph's hands. And then later on, then Pharaoh called him out of there, and he was able to interpret his two dreams. And then we know what happened after that. Then comes Moses. Moses understood that Yahweh, because of what Joseph had said to them before his death, that God would send them a deliverer, and they would take him from there into Canaan, a land flowing with milk and honey, as we see in this Torah portion. Moses understood that. So when he saw the Egyptian abusing his brethren, and Moses knew he was a Hebrew, it wasn't hidden from him. He understood that this was his brother, this Egyptian, was beating to the point where he thought he was going to kill him. So he went and killed the Egyptian for what he was doing to the Hebrew. And then the next day, he was confronted with this again because he was trying to judge between two brethren fighting, and they were coming to blows. And he said, "Why do you fight?" He said, "Well, are you going to do what you did to the Egyptians? The Egyptian and hid them in the sand? Are you going to do the same to us? And who made you a ruler over us?" He was in Pharaoh's house. He was already a ruler in Egypt over them. But there was something that we don't see, is that he was not in authority to take care of the position of ruling over them to the point to where he could decide between the two who was right, who was wrong. He wasn't in that authority at that point. He was being trained into it, and God was training him to do that job. But it was going to be a 40-year period between the time of this event and the time where he was going to come back to Egypt and rule over Pharaoh, basically. He was going to tell Pharaoh, "This is what God says, release my people and so they can serve me in the wilderness." So it would take another 40 years before his training would be complete for Yahweh to use him. I find it interesting. His training, he was leading sheep. And Yahweh said, "We're like sheep. All of us have gone astray. We don't know where we even are supposed to be going to a lot of times. We're blinded. We just only see what's in front of us. And we're waiting for our master to come and take us home." And when Moses came back, the whole thing was different. The people actually started listening to him. He showed them the proofs that Yahweh gave to him. He showed him the proof of turning his hand from a good hand to leprosy to, to restore him. He showed them the snake, the staff that became a snake, and they picked it up again and became a staff again. He showed them by pouring out the water, and it turned into blood. Might as well be somebody else using water and turning it into wine. He was a savior to them. He was acting in that on behalf of Yeshua at that point. When God calls us, are we going to run in fear as Jonah did? Or are we going to actually stand up and do what is right and lead the people as he called us to? We should be striving to be leaders over men and companies and all these things that the world goes after, as Yeshua said. But he's given us special abilities to do certain things, certain tasks at a certain time. And this is what we need to be focusing on, is doing what he says when he says to do it. And if it's leading 10 people from prison into freedom, well, then that's what we need to do. And that is not going into the prison in, like, Washington State. That's going and taking them from the enemy's camp, Satan, and bringing them into the light of Yeshua. When he called you, what did you do? I want you to take a look at two more people. It was called by Yahweh, Saul and David. These two men were as different as night and day, and yet they were both called. Yet because of the choices each had made, they had different destinies according to the choices they had made. According to 1 Samuel chapter 9, verses 1 and following, Saul was called to be anointed king. When he was called, he was looking for his donkeys. And I put in brackets, asses. He was looking for his donkeys. And day before that happened, God told Samuel that this young man would be coming to him looking for his donkeys. He was out there looking around, and it's like, what are you looking for? Oh, you know what? The ones that you're looking for are already back home. So don't worry about them. Come and meet with me, and I'll tell you what God has in mind for you. Samuel anointed him as king of Israel, but they had a king whom Israel rejected, which was Yahweh. Imagine that. They already had a king, and they rejected him carte blanche. Said, we want a man that we can see, that we can touch, we can handle. We can hear directly from his lips what he wants us to do. We'll serve him. Well, look how many thousand years gone by, and this is still the same way today. They reject God. In fact, 2,000 years ago, they rejected the king of Israel and killed him. We killed him. Because we said, oh yeah, now he's a man, but because of our sin, we can't accept him. We will reject him out of him. And we will not have him as our king. We want our own king, one from the line of Solomon. We want that one. Well, they're going to get him, and they're not going to like what he has to say to them, because he's going to fool them. And then after that, we're going to be done with him. He's going to kill them also. He wants them to serve him and him alone. He doesn't point them to Yahweh. He points them to himself, and he's self-serving, just as Saul was self-serving. Saul started well, but he quickly fell away and did the things that he thought he should do. He showed that he was after his own glory. He was a people pleaser, as we say today. He didn't want to please God. Well, he says so through his lips, oh yeah, I'm serving the same God you are, Samuel. Let's go and sacrifice to him. But he already made the mistake, and he had sacrificed on his own, so that people wouldn't leave, because he saw they were leaving. But he was king. He had the authority to stop them in their tracks and say, you will wait, and we'll wait on Samuel to come, because he said he's going to come at this point in time. He will be here. But if it takes a day more, so be it. But he did not. He wanted his own glory, and he sought after that. And God rejected him. He rejected Samuel just as much as the people of Israel rejected him. Not because God was evil, it's because they were after their own interests and they wanted to serve other gods. They were more pleasing to them. They got along better with these gods because they didn't require anything of them. Oh, yeah, occasional sacrifice, but they got to feed their own pleasures and their own desires. And Saul said, yeah, I like that idea. We'll do that. And what happened? He wound up committing suicide on the battlefield because he didn't want to fall into the enemy's hands. And unfortunately, his sons paid the price of his stupidity. Jonathan, the one that David was very close friends, they were like closer than brothers. Which brings us to David. David was the complete opposite of Saul. He was found by Samuel. And yet, because he was the least of his whole family, the least, he was the last one. He was out there minding the flocks. He was taking care of them, protecting them from bears and lions. He was doing the father's work. His father wanted him to tend the sheep. He tended the sheep. He was doing what his father told him to do. Just as much as we're supposed to be doing what our father tells us to do. To feed my flock. To take care of the ones that are downtrodden. The ones who are naked and oppressed. To take care of them. To stand up for the things that are righteous. When somebody's being oppressed, we stand in opposition to the oppressor. If it's something that they did not bring on themselves, and it's something that they're being oppressed for just because of what they believe, we need to stand up for our brethren. Because the time's running short, and we need to make sure that we have the answer now, what we're going to do at that day, because it is coming. And if we don't have that answer now, what are we going to do? We'll fail the test again. David was a shepherd and the least of his family. He was not much looked like. He looked at, although he was handsome, he was ruddy. He was not tall like Saul was tall, head and shoulders above everybody else. He could blend in with anybody in the crowd. Reminds me of somebody else. Yeshua. He wasn't much to look at either. He was tall. But he blended into the crowd like you wouldn't believe. They were chasing him, and they were going to throw him off a cliff. And then the next thing you know, he's walking through the crowd like, okay, what happened? Where did he go? He's behind you now. So, yet David protected his sheep from predators and kept watch over them. Where Saul was a people pleaser. He didn't care. He was the hired servant to take care of the flock, and yet he did not take care of the flock. He took care of himself. It was him, himself, and we would say, me, myself, and I. It was just for him, his ego, his pleasure, his satisfaction. David was the opposite. Yeah, he had his failings, and yet he repented of his failings. Saul never repented from his failings. Never. He died in his sin. He died as a result of what his poor decisions were that led to that point on the battlefield where he was mortally wounded and he committed suicide on the battlefield. He was a people pleaser. He was not concerned for the things of Yahweh. David had his failings, unlike Saul. He repented and strove to do the very best he could for Yahweh. And a man discerns Yahweh's heart, the heart of Yahweh. David was called a man after his very heart of Yahweh. Do you desire to do the heart of the king? Are you in it for the praise of men, or do you have a servant's heart? It's been said many times, you take care of the people, and the people take care of you. If you have a servant's heart, you are to take care of the needs of the people that you're with and those who are outside and inside. If they fear God, it's our responsibility to take care of them. Who else is going to do it if we don't do it? In the beginning, Samuel said, your heart will be changed, and it was changed. But he quickly reverted to his old ways. We can choose the path that we're on or embrace the path that he puts us on. We can do it either way. It's a lot better if we do the things according to his will and his purposes rather than our own desires. Because where is that going to lead us to? Oh, it's going to lead us to the wide path, the wide gate, where it leads to destruction. We choose the path according to our own flesh. Our training will either come from the heart of Yahweh or the way of man. It's been said to me many times, well, you don't have a degree. You should be teaching. You should be doing this. You should be doing that. But the degree doesn't mean anything if I'm not serving my king. I can have all the degrees. I can have all the praise and accolades of the people I work for, the pats on the back, the cigars, the whiskey, whatever it is, the entrapments of man. I can have all that. And yet if I have not love, I have done everything for nothing. It doesn't matter. Following Yahweh is not an easy path. It's laden with rocks and often mountains. When we reach the top, we see the beauty of all of creation. The thing about mountains is eventually you have to come down. You can't stay there. One, you need oxygen, and you go up so high. Two, you need food. Three, you need to be with the people that God wants you to be with. Taking the mountain path often is lonely. It's a time where we are the closest to Yahweh. This is where he can get to us. I'm reminded of Elijah. He was like, why are you here? Because she's going to kill me. And God saying, don't you know I have other people who are following me and not bow the knee to Baal? Why are you here? Oh, it's just me alone. Yahweh didn't answer him according to his heart as far as how he was feeling at the time of Jezebel wanting to kill him. He was responding to the need that he had in the community. He was supposed to anoint a man as king. He was supposed to do certain other things. And then pass his mantle onto his servant. Are we on that close path with him to where we see him and hear his voice? When we are alone with him and there's no competing noise or clamor of the sheep that are around us, and we hear his voice, we have to learn to hear his voice in that clamor. Look at Moses. Every time something went bad, what did he do? The first thing he did was hit the deck. As I was told in Navy, that's what the floor is. He would hit the floor, hit the ground, prostrate before Yahweh, and begging for Yahweh not to kill all these people. He interceded for us when we could not intercede for ourselves. When we do things, we could go on the easy path and listen to the easy voices of the pastors and behind the pulpit who only care about themselves and how much money they make, how many people they have in attendance, and how big is their congregation, how big is their meeting hall, how big is this, and their car that they drive, their houses that they have, how big is this, which sounds a lot like a used car salesman. There is no competing voices when we're on the mountaintop. There's no clamor of the sheep. He wants us all to hear his voice. And we should choose to listen to the voice. If we choose to listen to the easy path, because that's a wide path. It's easy. It's smooth. There's no curves or twists. It's all straight. And it leads to destruction, as Yeshua said. We should not seek to be a leader. Rather, we are servants of the King of Israel. He has given us gifts of ministry. He will appoint leaders whose job it is to lead all to Messiah. If we're not steering people to Yeshua, then it doesn't matter how big of a fellowship that we have. It doesn't matter how many people are in our camp. They're supporting us and doing all the right things. If we're not leading them to Yeshua, then you might as well just tear up the deed and you might as well just go home and go back to where you came from. Because it doesn't do anything except to give you the glory rather than him. When Joseph, Moses, and David were leaders, you didn't see them clamoring for glory for themselves. No, all the glory Yahweh, they all glorified Yahweh and listened to him for the lessons they needed to lead to his people They were listening for his voice, his instructions, his pleadings for the people. And he pleaded many times to the people not to do the things that they did, and yet they did it anyways. But when we look at other people like Saul, Korah, and Dathan, were self-serving. They did not want to listen to Yahweh. They rejected Yahweh and his kingship in the same way Israel rejected Yahweh in all aspects of life. They quickly fell away and turned to other man-made gods. In today's world, we substituted these gods for money, fame, and fortune. Where are you today? Whom do you serve? If you do not serve Yahweh, then by default, you serve the God of this world, Satan. You may seem shocked by this, but this is, if you reject God, there is no middle ground. The time is short. Yahweh is waiting for your final answer. Joseph, Moses, and David stayed faithful until the end. The question is, will we? When the times get tough, do we just throw up our hands and throw in the towel? Or do we stay on the path, as Paul said, finish the race? He says in this, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith in 2 Timothy 4:7. Let me finish with this, with words from Moses. This is out of Deuteronomy. See now today, I have set before you life and prosperity, death and disaster. This is what I am commanding you today. Love Yahweh with your God. Walk in his ways and keep his commandments, his statutes, and his ordinances. Then you will live and increase in number. And Yahweh Elohim will bless you in the land, and you are going to possess. But if your heart turns away and you do not listen, and you are lured away and bow down to other gods and serve them, then I declare to you today, that you will most certainly perish. You will not live a long life on the land that you're about to enter and possess by crossing over to Jordan. That's out of Deuteronomy 30:15-18. It's simple. We have two paths we can choose from. To go down the path that even Yeshua says a narrow, winding, hard, rocky path. And the gate is small and narrow. We can enter into that gate if we choose, or we can walk on by. Or we go down the path of least resistance and go with the crowd as they go by and they clamor and they say, oh, look at us, look at us, come to us. And then they have a party along the way, like in Mardi Gras. And that path is wide and broad, and the gate is wide and leads to destruction. We must listen to what he has to say and do what he says when he says to do it. These are the things of the kingdom. He wants us to love him with all of our soul and our whole being. And this is what David, Joshua, Moses all did. And that's what I'm having done.
Okay. Thank you, Rick, for that teaching. Does anyone have a comment or a question? Well, I can tell you that something that struck me was how already Moses is getting a taste of what these people are going to be like. You know, oh, well, you saved our Hebrew brother yesterday, but now you're coming to kill us. Oh, that's going to be the accusation from now on. Moses, you brought us out here to kill us. Moses has been falsely accused very often. I can tell you about that. What is the difference between the narrow path and the wide path? Well, on the narrow path, you stumble over the things in your path. Because there's not very many people on your path to push you around. Of course, we do run into some of those people once in a while. But on the wide path, it's that you do get pushed around by other people. And you stumble over your own feet, you know, on the smooth asphalt there. But I can tell you something that we found out about our olive trees. And this is this will tell you a lot about Israel. I'm going to change from path to tree symbolism. We have here in Jordan, we have discovered two diseases that affect olive trees. And our trees have one of them, and it is a common disease. It's called gall. It's where, you know, the bacteria, pests, and other things, you know, they burrow into the bark and they, you know, cause nests and they make knots in the tree branches and in the trunk and all of that. It's common, as I said. There's a less common disease, which is among some of the trees, especially from Turkey. They imported the trees from there. And that is a disease that the critters come up into the trunk from the inside. They hollow out the tree. They eat all the pulp on the inside. So here you've got an olive tree that represents Israel. And the two different kinds of pests are one from outside and one from inside. On the narrow path, the pest that we most meet is the one from inside. On the wide path, the one that we most meet is the one from outside. But Israel, as a nation, has for 4,000 years been infested both from outside and from within. Dee, you had your hand up. Okay. You had your hand up, but you're putting your hand up now. So anybody else?
Hello. Was that? I'm sorry. I walked away for a minute. So, okay. My husband had a question, and just a second. Let me pull it up. Okay. He put it in the text. Okay. So he said that he was reading from another Torah teacher, something about that, Exodus 1:22, then Pharaoh commanded all his people, saying, every son who is born, you are to cast into the Nile, and every daughter you are to keep alive. And this Torah teacher thought that the word, where Pharaoh was commanding his people, that he was including his own people, the Egyptians, to also sacrifice their sons in the Nile River.
Okay. You want to answer that, Rick?
I don't have an answer for that right now.
Okay. So in Exodus 1:22, what we have here in chapter 1 actually is two different methods that the Pharaoh was going to use to kill the Hebrews. When you go to the book of Jasher, it is that Job, Jethro, and Balaam, yes, the Balaam that they met out there in the wilderness, were in the king's court, and they were either vassals or they were just acquainted with Pharaoh. Some, you know, there's a debate about what their status was with the Pharaoh. Nonetheless, Jasher says that they're in the court, and he asked them what the Egyptians should do with the Hebrews. Well, it turns out that Jethro told him to leave them alone. And Pharaoh told Jethro to leave the court. He threw him out of the court. Job said, you should do as sees fit in your own eyes. Now, we know Job had a story in that he lost all of his children. And so, you know, you want to be careful how you kind of try to schmooze up to somebody and kind of agree with them while not agreeing with them, because, you know, you always want to see that as you're agreeing with them. So here, let me take your kids. And then you have Balaam. Now, Balaam was in the business. He's an Edomite. He was in the business of, you know, wanting to destroy these Hebrew people. And so he is the one that suggested to Pharaoh, throw them in the Nile. Throw the baby boys into the Nile. Now, the purpose of that is it's trial by water. And here's how it went in the ancient world. If you survive being thrown in the water, then you're innocent of the charges against you. If you die, you are deemed to have been guilty of the charges against you. So Pharaoh believed that the Hebrews were traitors. And as they were throwing in these babies into the Nile, and they, of course, died in the water, Pharaoh was justified in his accusation. They died. They represent the whole Hebrew nation. And so it's true. And so, you know, this is why when we get to the Red Sea that we have this big trial by water, which is also a baptism. That's what baptism is. It is that you go through the trial by water and you come up innocent. So now here in Exodus 1:22, Pharaoh is commanding all of his people to do what the Hebrew midwives will not do. And that is for them, the people, to cast the sons of the Hebrews into the river and to save the daughters alive. Now, we don't know how the Egyptians got access to the Hebrew sons, you know, because the Hebrew women were using midwives, and they were giving birth on their own, even without midwives. So we don't know. The scripture doesn't tell us how the Egyptians were getting access to kill the children, but we know that they were. That was part of the persecution, that they were killing the children. Oh, by the way, Egypt today is killing the children, and the women are voluntarily giving up their own children, which is an upgrade from, you know, other people coming along and killing the children. No, now this time the people are cooperating with Egypt. Just thought you'd like to hear that. Okay, Rick.
Okay, I look in the Brenton, and it does say this in verse 22, and Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, whatever male child shall be born to the Hebrews, cast into the river, and every female save it. So it's a matter of translations, but they added the word Hebrew, and I couldn't find it in the Hebrew itself text or in other versions, which we've gone to Masoretic. The even in the Greek, it doesn't say Hebrew. It's just, but in Britain, it translated with Hebrews.
Okay, anybody else? Does that, Dee, did that help at all?
Yes, it did. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Anybody else? Susan?
I kind of found it interesting that in the end, she does put him in the Nile. I mean, she made provision. He was in an ark in Aron, which kind of points to Noah's boat, but I just found it interesting that he does wind up in the Nile. And I also found it interesting that this ark or this basket that she is building is made out of reeds, and that he is going to be you know, whether it connects to the fact that he's going to be taking them through Yam Suf, the Reed Sea, you know, down the road. I just thought it was all kind of interesting.
Yes, he literally came through in the ark, which is a trial by water, that Moses was proven innocent of the accusation of Pharaoh. Julianne.
I have a question on Exodus chapter 4, verse 24. And it came to pass on the way at the encampment that the Lord met him and sought to kill him. Is there any other scripture or anything else that expands on this other than my concordance, which just says Moses didn't circumcise his son within the 8 days?
No, I don't know other place where you can read of anything different, but that is what the situation was. Moses failed to circumcise his son. And Zipporah, being a Midianite, was not necessarily on board with this circumcision thing. And then she threw his foreskin at Moses' feet and called him a bloody bridegroom. And this is I've taught on this before. This is a type and shadow of Christianity, in which they don't want to obey the law. They debate about the circumcision, whether you need it or not. And I've even heard it taught from the pulpit that Yahweh of the Old Testament was a bloody God, and that he was harsh and hard on people. And so this is kind of, you know, Zipporah had that same opinion. And so why Moses did not circumcise Gershom, I don't know. We don't have that explanation anywhere that I know of. Does anybody else have an explanation for that? Rick.
I didn't have an explanation for that, but I find it interesting. It was only one son that is circumcised there, not both.
Right.
So I found that interesting.
Because it's the firstborn, and they're going to Passover. And Yahweh, they have to be circumcised to partake of the Passover. And he's all males, but the firstborn son must. The secondborn son, maybe he would not partake of it or whatever. Hang on, Mary first and then Cheryl. Oh, Cheryl.
Yeah, I was just thinking that maybe the reason he hadn't done it was because of his wife.
Well, yeah.
And
yeah.
He had to do it himself. That would be
yeah,
my guess.
Yeah. Okay, Cheryl.
I think that might be the case, what you just said, and also didn't have something to do because they were just in the wilderness. No.
Because they were living with Midian.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have this problem of circumcision again when we come to Joshua. We have to have a hill of foreskins at, you know, as they cross over the river, they're getting ready to do Passover and nobody is circumcised. So this circumcision thing, has been a controversy in Israel from the beginning. Anybody else?
Have you ever heard the real reason why circumcision is done? At least from what I've heard. Excuse me.
Well, the script tells us why, but go ahead.
Well, one reason I heard is that it has to do with making it less likely for self-pleasuring and maybe also homosexuality. I'm not sure if the homosexuality was involved, but since the major sin that everyone seemed to get caught up in was sexual idolatry, it's sounds very logical to me that that could be a factor.
Well, okay, Rick, go ahead.
Okay, that's an error, because if you notice, when they're about ready to enter into the land, then the Midianites and another group, I can't remember who it was, but they caused them to sin in a immoral sexual activity with the Midianite gods and their god. You know, they were trying
Moabites.
To get... Huh?
Moabites.
Moabites, sorry, wrong people. All right.
Midianites and Moabites.
Okay, so they were in that. So the circumcision had nothing to do with that. In fact, if you look at the ancient way of doing it, it's not how we do it in the hospital. They only took a small part of it off. It snipped part of it off, and that was enough to draw the blood, and it wasn't the whole foreskin was taken off, just a little part of it. So even though it seems that way, it's not. It doesn't stop a man from doing sexual immorality.
The reason for the circumcision is because of the Son of Promise. The circumcision is the sign in the flesh of Abraham that his son will be the son of the covenant. Yeshua, the descendant of Abraham, must be the son of the covenant. And so along the way, in those intervening 4,000 years, you have to, Yahweh has to ensure that the seed that comes from all the males of Israel could be the one that will produce the Messiah. So all of the males are made part of the covenant so that their seed could produce the son of the covenant. Abraham had to produce the son of the covenant through the sign of the covenant. That's what the circumcision is for. Anybody else? Susan.
Well, on another level or a different way of looking, could we also say that it is the cutting off of flesh on the eighth day? Which means, you know, the eighth day just opens up a whole kind of a different realm. So, I mean, I kind of see it that way in addition to all the other things you said.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, we are going to have some flesh cut off beginning at the seventh day. The resurrection of the dead when Yeshua arrives and the transformation of those who are alive both represent the cutting off of flesh at the beginning of the seventh millennium as well. But certainly on the eighth day, all of the fleshiness of man, all this thing that wants to sin and rebel against Yahweh will be cut off. There won't be any more of this human flesh in the kingdom after, in the eighth day, starting in the eighth day. So that's a good point. Anybody else? Okay, well then let's go to the Haftarah at Isaiah 27. Start at verse 1 and go to 28, verse 13. Isaiah 27, verse 1. And it was Roger's turn. There he is. I saw that they left for a minute. They must have had some difficulties. Roger, would you start reading at Isaiah 1? Isaiah 27:1. Sorry.
27:1. On that day, Adonai, with his great, strong, relentless sword, will punish Leviathan with the fleeing serpent and twisting serpent Leviathan. He will slay the sea dragon or sea monster.
Are you there, Roger?
Yes, I read.
Can you hear me? I know, but it's through verse 5, unless you don't want to read.
I do. On that day, Pleasant Vineyard, sing about it. I, Adonai, guard it. Moment to moment, I water it so that no harm will come to it. I guard it night and day. I have no anger in me. If it gives me briars and thorns, then as in war, I will trample it down and burn it up at once, unless it takes hold of my strength. In order to make peace with me, yes, to make peace with me.
Okay, and would your wife like to read 6 through 10?
The time is coming when Yaakov will take root, Israel will burn and flower, and fill the whole world with a harvest. Adonai will strike Israel as he did others who struck Israel. He will not kill them as he did the others. Your controversy with her is fully resolved by sending her into exile. He removes her with a rough gust of wind on a day when it is blowing from the east. So the iniquity of Yaakov is atoned for by this of wounding. His sin produces this result. He chops up all the open stones like chalk. Sacred poles and sun pillars stand no more. For the fortified city. Oh, sorry.
No, that's okay. You had one more, and I interrupted you. Go ahead, one more. Okay, Hillary, verses 10 through 13, please. I'm having a little hard time hearing you, ma'am, so I'm going to let Hillary read. Hillary, verses 10 through 13, please. Okay, Julianne, Isaiah 27, verses 10 through 13, please.
When its boughs are withered, they will be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore, he who made them will not have mercy on them, and he who formed them will show them no favor. And it shall come to pass in that day that the Lord will thresh from the channel of the river to the brook of Egypt, and you will be gathered one by one, O you children of Israel. So it shall be in the day the great trumpet will be blown. They will come who are about to perish in the land of Assyria, and they who are outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship the Lord in the holy mount at Jerusalem.
Okay, I apologize to everybody because I'm having, sometimes it's breaking up here on this end and I can't really tell what's happening. But we'll continue. Isaiah 28, 1 through 5. Dawn.
Woe to the crown of pride, to the drunkards of Ephraim, whose glorious beauty is a fading flower, which is at the head of the verdant valleys, to those who are overcome with wine. Behold, the Lord has a mighty and strong one, like a tempest of hail and a destroying storm, like a flood of mighty waters overflowing, who will bring them down to the earth with his hand. The crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim, will be trampled underfoot, and the glorious beauty is a fading flower, which is at the head of the verdant valley, like the first fruit before the summer, which an observer sees. He eats it up while it is still in his hand. In that day, Yahweh of hosts will be for a crown of glory and a diadem of beauty to the remnant of his people.
And Bill, would you read verses 6 through 13 just to finish up this Haftarah, please?
He will also be a spirit of justice for whoever sits as a judge, and a source of strength for all those repelling enemy attacks at the gate. But there are others reeling from wine, staggering about because of strong liquor. Kohen and prophet reel from strong liquor. They are confused by wine, led astray by strong liquor. They err in their visions and stumble when judging. All tables are covered with vomit and feces. Not a single place is clean. Can no one be taught anything? Can no one understand the message? Must one teach barely weaned toddlers, babies just taken from the breast, so that one has to use nursery rhymes? Zava lazav, zava lazav, kav lakav, kav lakav, zair sham, zair sham. Precept by precept, precept by precept, line by line, line by line. A little here, a little there. So with stammering lips in a foreign accent, Yahuwah will speak to this people. He once told this people, it's time to rest. The exhausted can rest. Now you can relax. But they wouldn't listen. So now the word of Yahuwah for them comes precept by precept, precept by precept, line by line, line by line, a little here, a little there, so that when they walk, they stumble backward and are broken, trapped, and captured.
Okay, and then Mary, chapter 28. Wait a minute, let me look at this. It's 29, sorry. Mary 29, verses 22 to 24. Are you there, Mary?
Yes. Therefore, thus says Yahweh, who redeemed Abraham concerning the house of Jacob. Jacob will now not be ashamed, neither will his face now wax pale. But when he sees his children, the work of my hands in his midst, they will sanctify my name and sanctify the Holy One of Jacob and will revere the God of Israel. They also who erred in the spirit will come to understand, and those who murmured will learn instruction.
Okay. Any comments about the Haftarah? Go ahead, Rick.
Back to where I was talking about the vomiting on the tables. And
yeah.
That the table represents the teaching, where you would sit at to learn from the teacher. It could have been the simple stone. It could have been a place where you, a formal table. It's where you would learn at. In school, we would know that as a desk. But every single square inch was covered in vomit and feces. There was nothing to write on. It was just corrupt. It's about our state of being, our corruptness inside of our bones, and it's just like we're dead men standing, as it's often stated. So in this, Yahweh is saying, what, we have to go to the babies who are just now being weaned off their mother's breast to teach them? He's ridiculing them because they're not wanting to learn. They're so much into what they want to do. This is a carry-on from what Saul did back in his time and to this point, that they still don't want to listen. They rejected God then. They rejected here. And this is Torah course, this part of the Torah, that they just said, we don't want anything to do with you. And it gets to the point where it gets into the Gospels where they rejected him to the point of death. This is how bad it gets. And he's going to say, okay, you don't want to live with me? Fine. You're going to be in eternal darkness and fire and corruption and confusion and darkness. That's it.
Anybody else? One of the things that connects this Haftarah to the Torah portion is that Yahweh is trying to give these people rest. And we're going to find out that, as we did, you know, when Moses helped them, they accused him of trying to rule over them. You know, we have their, and he says in here, in the Torah portion, they're not going to believe me. You know, he knows what kind of people these are. So Yahweh's trying to give them rest back then. And here in Isaiah, Yahweh is trying to give them rest again, but they have to do what he says. And they don't want to do what he says. And then it's going to happen again in the end of days. He's going to try to give his people rest. Will they come? Will they come to the place of rest, which is the wilderness where Moses was going to take them to out of Egypt? Isaiah 27:13 says it will happen in that day that a great trumpet. Oh, the book of Revelation has some trumpets in it. A great trumpet will be blown, and those who were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and those who were outcasts in the land of Egypt will come, and they will worship Yahweh in the holy mountain at Jerusalem. Now notice that Yahweh is going to take the people to Sinai, but here the holy mountain is Jerusalem. This is where we're going. We're not going to Sinai this time. And by the way, the Assyrian captivity was not declared to be over. The Babylonian captivity was declared to be over. But the Assyrian captivity was not declared over, nor was the Roman captivity. So we're all still in this captivity of Assyria and Rome and so forth. So when the trumpet blows, are you going to follow the calling? You know, that's what the trumpet is. It's calling you. We're going to read that in the, you know, throughout the year in the Torah, what the trumpets do. They call to action. Trumpets call you to action. So when you are being called to do, you'll have a choice to make, as Rick said today in his teaching. Anybody else? Okay, well then let's go on and we will go to Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12.
I had one observation.
Okay, go ahead. Go ahead.
I'm sorry, I was slow at the draw. I was on the wrong page. Isaiah 28:3 says, the crown of pride, the drunkards of Ephraim will be trampled underfoot. Then it says, it talks about, this is about the remnant of his people in verse 5. And then down in verse 7, it talks about they also have erred through wine and through intoxicating drink or out of the way. The priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. They have swallowed up by wine. And it talks about intoxicating drink. And that reminds me of Revelation 17:2 and 18:3, with whom the kings of the earth have committed fornication and the inhabitants of the earth have been made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And 18:3 also talks about being drunk with the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And it says in verse 9 in Isaiah that, you know, he's having problems. Who's he going to teach? You know, he's talking about the remnant of his people. That I think this intoxicating drink could certainly be in reference to fornication at the end of days, as in Revelation, because it's causing his people to err and not hear. And then as Rick was talking about the vomit of the tables and the filth, I think that's all this end times fornication that we see right now is causing people to err and his remnant to, well, it even says specifically here, the priest and the prophet have erred through intoxicating drink. It's just rampant fornication and rampant sexual immorality that we're seeing today, I think, may be part of this. Just a thought.
That's a good comment. Rick?
When it's talking about the priest, the only time we're in the Torah talks about the priest not supposed to be drinking is when they're going to go into the tabernacle itself, the ministry before Yahweh. Anything to do with the offerings, the slaughtering, when they enter in that gate, they're not supposed to be drinking at all. This is the same problem that Aaron's two sons died because they were drunk and they brought a strange fire before Yahweh. So in much the same way, the priest, I don't know if it's the Levites or I don't think it's Melchizedek at this point. We're talking about this section we just read, but they're drunk with strong drink, not just wine. They made dizzy to where they couldn't even stand to perform their task. And this is what the whole reasoning was of Yahweh said, you're not to have any drink when you go into my sanctuary to minister before me, because you're not going to have a pool in my house. You're going to go home. And this is what I got out of that.
Dawn, you have your hand up still.
Yeah, I was just actually equating the intoxicating drink of the priest and the prophet to like the priests who are pedophiles and they're committing fornication and wickedness through sexual immorality. And then the prophet as, you know, like the I don't know, for lack of a better example, the televangelists who keep getting caught in fornication and adultery and that kind of thing. That's the drunkenness of the wine that Revelation is speaking about, I think.
Yeah, that's very good. It's a good association between that. Yeah, because it's priest and prophet. So I think that's a good insight. Anybody else? Susan.
Yeah, I see the whole thing as everything is perverse except this newborn child taken from the breast. There is no innocence. There is no purity. And I think we see that today as they come for the children now as young as they can get them. And it's just heartbreaking, which is kind of another question of, you know, when Abraham was petitioning for the righteous, on behalf of the righteous in Sodom, you know, I don't know what level we're at right now, but when it comes to that level, that's all that's pure and innocent is from taken from the breast. Everything else is polluted. That's kind of how I see that.
Yeah, that's good. That's very good. Anybody else? Okay, then let's go to Matthew chapter 2, and we'll read from verse 1 through verse 12. So I'll read, and then Michael can finish up to verse 12, and then we'll go to Acts 7. Now when Yeshua was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of King Herod, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, where is he who is born King of the Jews? For we saw his star in the east and have come to worship him. When King Herod heard it, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Gathering together all the chief priests and the scribes of the people, he asked them where the Messiah would be born. They said to him, in Bethlehem of Judea, for this is written through the prophet. Michael 6, and then just finish to 12.
But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not the least among the rulers of Judah. You shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod, when he had secretly called the wise men, determined from them what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the young child, and when you have found him, bring back word to me that I may come and worship him also. When they heard the king, they departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them, till it came and stood over where the young child was. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. And when they had come into the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother, and fell down and worshipped him. And when they had opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Then being divinely warned in a dream that they should not return to Herod, they departed for their own country another way.
Okay. Anybody have a comment on this? Go ahead.
The star, okay. I was reading in Jasher about the event of Moses' birth. There was signs in the heaven, and it was talking about that they interpreted as there was going to be somebody born of the Israelites that would come and deliver them from the hands of the Egyptians. This is not in Genesis, or actually in Exodus, by the way. But Pharaoh actually had two dreams associated with the same idea. There would be a deliverer born of the Israelites. And so that's why this is why that then he told, instructed the midwives to do this. That was his first inkling to do, is to destroy the men, male children being born at birth. So when they saw this star, this is back in Babylon. This is when Daniel was there, and he was telling them how what to look for and all this stuff. So those people were looking for the star to come. And from the time they saw the star to the time of when Yeshua was born, it was about, one time they looked for him, it was about 2 years had gone by. So this is why that the 2-year-olds and younger were killed.
Right.
Because they wanted to make sure that would not happen. And he was more looking at his own kingship, and that this guy was going to come along and take it away from him.
Well, and then also the story here, in starting in verse 13, talks about, Joseph taking the Mary and the baby to Egypt, and Herod killing the children. And here it is, in Yeshua's day, Egypt was the safe place. In Moses' day, Egypt was the bad place, was the persecution place. Now, the obvious connection here also, another obvious connection, is that Moses is a type and shadow of Yeshua, because this harks back to Egypt, but not necessarily in Matthew 2, verses 1 through 12. You have to make that connection starting in verse 2:13, but Moses is a type and shadow of Yeshua. Is there anyone else that has a comment?
Yeah, my footnote for verse 3 says, Herod and many in Jerusalem were Hellenists, whose power and wealth was based on Roman authority. And also another footnote says, for verse 11, says that they were in a house, not the cave barn where he was born, indicates some time had passed since his birth.
Yeah, and I saw that also, that what this is telling us is that the Jerusalem Jewish leadership was in cahoots with King Herod. The high priest got his annual chance to be the high priest from, purchasing that office from the Romans. It started with the Greeks, but now the Romans are doing it. And King Herod, he's an Edomite. He's a type and shadow of the Antichrist. And the Jewish leadership being in cahoots with the anti-Messiah, that wants to kill the Messiah from the beginning. And oh, by the way, in the rest of the Gospels and in the rest of the story of Yeshua, those Pharisees and Sadducees, they try to hide that they keep asking, are you the Messiah? when they've been told right here by some foreigners that came into town looking for him, where's the Messiah? And then Herod asks them, where is the Messiah going to be born? And they tell him in Bethlehem of Judea. Yeah, they know who he was. They just didn't want to either believe it or they wanted to make him say that he was the Messiah so that the Romans would kill him for them. And that's exactly how they killed him, because he could not be, okay, in AD 30, see, there are some who I've been researching online, you know, some people believe that he was crucified in AD 28, but it was in AD 30 that the authority of capital punishment was taken away from the Jews by the Romans. And so the reason why they had to manipulate the situation to get the Romans to put Yeshua on the cross and kill him is because they no longer had the authority to take somebody out and punish them. So I believe that it's more probable that he was crucified in AD 31, because that would have been the time when they would not have been able to take authority over him and, you know, stone him or whatever they would have done. Go ahead, Dawn.
I had never heard that before. If that's the case, then how were they able to stone Stephen?
Well, the way that they did that was because it was a mob. It was not a lawful act that they did. It was not legal. And so the leadership could just say, we didn't have anything to do with that. The mob did it. You know, it's kind of like what the United States does today. You know, they go around and they stir the pot, because the U.S. doesn't have authority in other countries to go in and start, you know, doing legal proceedings against people and punishing them and so forth. But they can go in the countries and stir up the mobs. Oh, by the way, they do that. It's called Black Lives Matter and some other things. You know, I can't remember the two groups that I'm thinking of, Black Lives Matter and another one that came up a few years ago.
Antifa.
Oh, I kept wanting to say Intifada, but I knew that was not right. Although, you know, the Intifadas might be, you know, the U.S. in there in the West Bank stirring up the pot, the Palestinians against the Jews. And, you know, the U.S. is into that kind of thing. And so the mob that killed Stephen did not represent the Jewish leadership, but yet it did the will of the Jewish leadership, if that makes sense. Okay, anybody else? All right, then we now go to Acts chapter 7. That's Acts 7, and we start at we go from 17 to 35. Cheryl, would you read 17 to 25?
But as the time of the promise was approaching, which Elohim had assured to Abraham, the people increased and multiplied in Egypt, until there arose another king over Egypt who knew nothing about Joseph. Just a moment. It was he who took shrewd advantage over the race, our race, and mistreated our father so that they would expose their infants and that they would not survive. And it was at this time that Moses was born, and he was lovely in the sight of Elohim, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. And After he had been exposed, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and deeds.
Two more, 25.
But when he was approaching the age of 40, he entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. When he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance. Took vengeance of the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that Elohim was granting them deliverance and through him. But they did not understand.
And Rick, 26 through 30, please.
Then the next day, he came across two of them while they were fighting, and he tried to reconcile them. He said, "Men, you are brothers. Why are you harming each other?" But one who was harming his neighbor pushed him away, saying, "Who made you ruler and judge over us? Do you want to kill me the same way you killed the Egyptian yesterday?" At this remark, Moses fled and lived as an exile in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. After 40 years had passed, an angel of Yahweh appeared to him in the wilderness of Mount Sinai in the flames of a burning bush.
And Susan, verses 31 to 35, and that will finish our Brit Hadashah.
And when Moshe saw it, he began to marvel at the sight. And as he approached to look more closely, there came the voice of Adonai. "I am the Elohim of your fathers, the Elohim of Abraham and Isaac and Yaakov." And Moshe shook with fear and would not venture to look. But Yahweh said to him, "Take off the sandals from your feet, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. I have certainly seen the oppression of my people in Egypt and have heard their groans, and I've come down to deliver them. Come now, and I will send you to Egypt." This Moshe, whom they disowned, saying, "Who made you a ruler and a judge?" is the one whom Elohim sent to be both ruler and a deliverer with the help of the angel who appeared to him in the thorn bush.
Thank you. And that ends our Torah, Haftarah, and Brit Hadashah readings for today. And you know what I'm thinking of is, because I'm doing research online about, you know, all the dates that people are putting on Yeshua's birth, which they then relate to his death. And then, of course, you run into all kinds of things about the rapture. Well, here it says that Yeshua comes down to deliver them. He's not going to do something different. This time, he's going to come down and deliver his people this time. But additionally, he's going to take his people into their land, where they will then obey him and love and serve him eternally. Anybody else? Rick.
Something I was, one of the references I was reading in preparation for the Torah portion said that the person that was challenging Moses at the time he was judging between two brethren was Dathan. I found that it's interesting because Dathan is the one that opposed him with Korah. And here we have Korah, who was the leader of all these people, but Dathan's never one to submit to Moses and what Yahweh had given him as a leadership. So he didn't want to submit to him. He didn't want to submit to Yahweh. He wanted to go back to Egypt. In fact, he was very arrogant about the whole thing. He made Moses come to him. Well, when we look at that, it's like we have to check ourselves. If we are in leadership, God put us there for a reason. And we need to look at it that, what does he want to accomplish through us being the leader of this, even 5 people, 10 people, or 100 or 1,000? Is it something that he wants us to learn? And what is the training that he has prepared us through our lifetime to do that job?
So.
Yes. Okay. Anybody else? All right. Well, thank you all for coming and being in the room and participating and, we'll see you back here next week. And so I'm going to pray. Father, we thank you that you have allowed us to come together and that we can study your word and get some fuel for our walk and some inspiration and understand a little more about what you're trying to do with us in these end of days. So, Father, I thank you that you're working with all of us. I pray that you'll be with all of us. Provide for and protect each one of us and bring us all back together next Shabbat in Yeshua's name. Amen.
Amen.
And Shabbat Shalom, everybody.
Amen. Shabbat Shalom.
From New Mexico.
Shabbat Shalom.